Ayatollah Khamenei stressed that the main yardstick for the unity of Muslims is the issue of Palestine, calling for more seriousness on efforts to restore the rights of the Palestinians for the sake of Islamic unity. We earnestly hope the heads of Muslim states who have betrayed the Palestinians will reflect on their misdeeds, repent, and make amendments in order to return to Islamic unity by strengthening the ranks of the Ummah against the enemies of Islam and Muslims.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, criteria for assessment of intellect and ignorance. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. The tongue is the most important window to man's soul, the key to understanding his personality, and the best means for assessment of the degree of his intellect. Through a simple and seemingly unimportant rotation, this tongue of ours unveils the curtains and reveals the inner realities of man's soul. You know, when you talk to someone, when you discuss something with someone, when they open up their mouth, when they start discussing something with you, when they put forth a notion, when they put forth an opinion, the way they talk, the way they express their sentiments, all of it is a reflection of their personality. All of it is a reflection of the state of their soul and the state of their heart. Tongue is something that unveils the state of spirit and soul for the others. How many times we look at someone, when you look at their personality, they look apparently and in, you know, physically to be very stable. But as soon as they start speaking, as soon as they start discussing something, you see that this person is so confused. He doesn't know what he's doing with his life. His opinions are off. His take on different issues is baseless. So tongue is something that can be used for assessment of intellect and ignorance. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the criteria for assessment of intellect and ignorance. And we said one of the most important criteria is tongue. When somebody starts to speak, when somebody starts to express, when they lay out their sentiments on the table using their tongue, you start to understand the intellectual level of that person. For this reason, many Islamic instructions are focused on correction of tongue, and we are admonished frequently by our great leaders to be careful in what we say. It is true that complete correction of tongue is probably impossible without correction of soul and mind, but we can avoid a lot of pain and painful consequences of inappropriate movements of tongue through silence and self-control in our speech. Without purification of soul and without purification of mind, our speech is also not going to be solid and stable and pure. But at the same time, when you look at this dilemma, at the same time, how do you then control your tongue? It is through practicing silence and self-control. Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, the tongue is the criteria for assessment of insolence or ignorance and the scale of intellect and wisdom. This is how important of a role our tongue plays in our lives. Our tongue depicts our personality. It brings to light our spiritual state and our moral state and our inner state. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Armed drones have become a staple of modern American warfare, placing operators at a historically unprecedented remove from danger. At the same time, they have exposed those targeted, whether combatants or civilians, to a form of violence that they can neither defend themselves against nor surrender to. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Murtaza Hussein, journalist. This article is published under the heading Psychological Tools and Moral Hazards of Drone Warfare. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. On what would be the last day of his life, Zimari Ahmadi, an employee of a US-based NGO, was being watched by a remote crew piloting a Predator drone above the skies of Kabul, Afghanistan. As Ahmadi went about his work running a series of errands across the city, the drone operators, though they did not know his identity, were making plans to kill him. A series of innocuous actions like Ahmadi loading water containers into his car were interpreted in the minds of the operators watching as sinister preparations for a suicide bomb attack. After surveilling Ahmadi for several hours, the drone operators issued a death sentence, firing a hellfire missile at his car as he drove up to his home just as three children were rushing out to greet him. A total of 10 people, all civilians, were killed in the attack that the U.S. military had initially insisted had targeted a terrorist working with the Daesh. The death of Ahmadi and his family members were unique in the level of public attention they received. It was sadly unremarkable, though, in the context of the larger U.S. drone war that has been waged over the past 20 years. Armed drones have become a staple of modern American warfare, placing operators at a historically unprecedented remove from danger. At the same time, they have exposed those targeted, whether combatants or civilians, to a form of violence that they can neither defend themselves against nor surrender to. Freed from the traditional reciprocity of war in which both sides put their lives on the line, drone operators have become more like judicial executioners, putting people on trial on the other side of the planet without due process and meting out death sentences by remote control. The U.S. pioneered this style of warfare but is no longer alone in using what is technically called unmanned aerial vehicles or UAVs. Other countries, including U.S. rivals, are ramping up their own drone programs, signaling that this style of killing at great distance is likely to become a defining feature of war in the 21st century. Other drone operators describe experiencing physiological distress during their missions, as well as brief bursts of adrenaline following successful shots that supported friendly ground forces engaged in active combat. When they were asked to describe their worst day on the job, many of their responses dealt with what drone crews saw in the aftermath of certain strikes. One sensor operator on a drone described their worst day to Phelps this way: watching the son of the person I just obliterated with a hellfire missile pick up the pieces of his father. It wasn't the act of killing I focused on. It was watching the boy's face and interactions with the rest of his family that continue to haunt me, unquote. In countries like Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, the U.S. has carried out thousands of strikes in the absence of a meaningful U.S. ground presence. The people being killed on the ground in these strikes usually do not and indeed cannot pose any conceivable threat to Americans. Rennie argues, with reference to philosophical traditions like just war theory, that this makes even many purportedly legitimate drone targets, particularly the low-level rural foreign fighters who bear the brunt of drone program, little different from civilians. The concept of war as a legal and morally regulated activity was historically built on an assumption of mutual risk and danger among those taking part. That dynamic simply no longer exists when one side is fighting only with robots from the other side of the planet. While prior technological advances may have reduced the structural threat between combatants, drone warfare is the first time that one side has made themselves absolutely immune to violence. Redick writes, UAV exclusive violence marks a fundamental shift in the nature of hostilities from an adversarial contention to something more closely approximating judicial sanction. One outcome of this shift has been dehumanization of those targeted by the United States. What emerges in place of war as a situation of mutual risk is simply an unending series of executions carried out from the skies. The task of the people carrying out many strikes is less about overcoming an enemy in battle than issuing moral judgments and death sentences against individuals who pose no conceivable threat to the U.S. and whose customs, circumstances, and even identities are often unknown to them. To use a chilling metaphor, Renick argues that killing through drone strikes outside of active combat situations is less like war, as traditionally defined, and more like a creative process of disinfection. In cases where drones are targeting high-level terrorists who are directly planning attacks against the U.S. or where they're supporting friendly ground forces in combat, the strikes are more justifiable according to traditional moral schema. These are not often the circumstances of drone strikes. Thousands of strikes have taken place outside of active combat zones over the years or have targeted low-level fighters or even unarmed individuals who posed no direct threat to U.S. forces or even civilians. An investigative report recently published by the military-focused news site Connecting Vets, including leaked footage of many strikes, outlined the extent to which U.S. military commanders became obsessed with killing low-level suspected Taliban members in Helmand Province, Afghanistan during a 2019 drone campaign. After initially trying to cover up the killings of Zimari Ahmadi and his family in Kabul, the Pentagon subsequently backtracked following a stream of news reports disproving their narrative about killing ISIS terrorists. Though it was forced to admit responsibility, the military has said that no disciplinary action would be taken against anyone involved in the attack that took the lives of 10 members of an innocent family. If drone warfare, whether autonomous or not, is to have any moral component at all, it must include some accountability for the innocent people regularly killed in strikes like the one that ended the life of Zimari Ahmadi. Periodic apologies aside, moral responsibility toward the tens of thousands killed, maimed, or deprived of their loved ones over the past 20 years has been in short evidence. Amal Ahmadi, Zimari's brother, told reporters in the aftermath of the drone strike, "That is not enough for us to say sorry. The United States of America can see from everywhere. They can see that there were innocent children near the car and in the car. Whoever did this should be punished. It is not right."
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, and other life forms. You are listening to Youth Station. Thank you so very much for joining us, you guys. I'm Zainab, and I'm joined by brother Hassan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Aikum assalam. How are you, sister?
How you been? Brother Hassan.
Yeah.
How old are you?
I'm 21.
All right, so you're 21.
Yeah.
And you and I only know each other on work basis,
yeah.
Right? We only see each other in the studio. And I personally find you to be a mature young
individual. Well, thank you so much for that. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, I really mean it. You know, I don't want to be sexist about it, but I, from my personal experience, mm-hmm. really feel that men
mm-hmm.
reach maturity a little slower than women.
In Islam, the women reach the age of puberty before men, right?
How would we define maturity even? What is maturity?
Okay, it's actually interesting. When I was thinking about maturity, I thought of the same thing what I found on Wikipedia. Like what Google says about it.
I thought of the same thing. Very interesting. You and Wikipedia think alike. Congratulations.
Yeah, somewhat. Like, not on all matters, though. So, it says that in psychology, maturity is the ability to respond to the environment and being aware of the correct time and location to behave and knowing when to act according to the circumstances and the culture of the society one lives in.
Oh, wow. No, I'm not mature at all then.
I guess you are according to this.
Especially according to that description, I don't think I'm mature at all. Maybe it has something to do with... Okay, I'm very socially awkward.
Okay, like first, let us clear that, you know, one doesn't become mature by just simply saying that I'm a mature guy. One can be a mature person with the people he's living around if they say that, okay, so we agree that he's a mature person. Like, no one becomes rich just by simply saying I'm rich. So you have to have that thing.
Yeah, obviously.
To actually be it.
Manifest it.
Yeah, yeah. So mature is what I think is, you know... just, you know, dealing with the life situations, how
Definitely.
You deal with it, and doing the right things at right time.
Doing the right thing at the right time.
Yeah.
Saying the right thing at the right
exactly,
time, you know?
Yeah.
Because sometimes you're just in a social gathering, there isn't necessarily a requirement for an action, but a single word or a sentence can just throw the air
True.
Of the entire gathering off,
yeah.
and it would be really awkward. So what I've learned as a socially impaired individual... Mm-hmm. is that my solution mm-hmm. is silence. You know, you don't need to talk unless
solution
you're...
Solution for what?
Huh?
Solution for what?
Solution for... See, I'm socially anxious, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm afraid of saying the wrong thing at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And before, I would try to analyze my thoughts meticulously to a point of overthinking it, you know, to a point of pushing myself... toward the border of hysteria because, oh, is it going to offend anyone? Is it disrespectful? Is it funny? Is it not funny? Is it this? Is it that? And then after I said it, based on reaction or not, I would think about it for days. Should I have said that? Should I have not?
So that's really confusing, right?
It is. It is. And it's frustrating because it triggers my anxiety and I feel like, they just hate me now, right? I was acting totally immature in that setting. Brothers and sisters, we're going to go on a short break, so please stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So, talking about maturity, what do?
Let me quote a hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
Sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
It says that in Arabic, it says, "Qul khayran al uskut.
Yes.
Like speak good or remain silent.
Remain silent. Yeah. Exactly. Or there's, I think, a hadith that speak if your speech is better than your silence.
Yeah, yeah, it's from Imam Ali. That, yeah, exactly. You know, speak only when you think your words are more beautiful than silence.
Exactly. And oftenly, I mean, unless it's an academic topic or something that I
So now you see, this is called maturity. You should know when to remain silent.
Yeah.
Like, being silent is not always a solution,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, unless
there's a
you're
certain
spoken
time,
to.
Yeah, there's a certain time where you have to speak.
Mm.
Like, you knowing that where to remain silent.
Yeah, like if someone asks you, Salam, how are you, Zainab?
Yeah.
And I'm just silent. Well, I'm immature all over again.
Exactly.
What
like
are you,
knowing
six?
Where to speak, when to speak, what to speak, that's, you know, that you can call it as maturity.
Yeah. Aside from speaking, I think, I don't know, again, I don't want to make this a sexist thing, but with men, you know, like among yourselves, right?
Uh-huh.
Tell me that you guys don't go around playing jokes, pulling pranks on each other, teasing each other, dumping buckets of water out of nowhere on each other. You guys do that.
No, you know, it's
boys
actually really difficult to, you know, frame it in a sentence because you can never generalize people.
Ah, for sure.
So, you know, you can find someone dumb as hell, mm-hmm. another, like, you know, really smart and genius.
Mm.
So we can find, you know, all types of people, all types of men and women. So
mm-hmm.
that's the thing.
Or even in gatherings,
uh-huh.
right? Men are more prone to play jokes on each other.
Yeah.
And laugh out loud.
The,
like
yeah,
the
that,
big
that I might agree.
Belly
yeah.
laugh, like, ho, 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 ho.
Yeah,
ho.
I might agree with that.
Then
yeah.
women, right? Women are just sitting around sipping their tea
mm-hmm.
and, like, making soft little giggles. Maturity, I think, depends
yeah.
a lot on context, right?
Mm-hmm.
It depends, like, what you said, what you read
yeah.
off Wikipedia or Google, whatever, that it depends on the environment you're in.
Yeah.
So if that masculine environment calls for being
mm-hmm.
a little goofy and silly, then
yeah.
it's that doesn't necessarily consider as being immature anymore, right?
Yeah.
And likewise for women,
mm-hmm.
if their environment calls for, you know, soft laughter and
yeah.
complimenting each other's dresses and really gentle jokes and whatnot, then that's, you know, that's good
mm-hmm.
good for them.
You know, apart from speaking and all, I think mature is also about dealing with your day-to-day life. How, you know, you come across any situation, how to act it, like, you know, your reaction.
When was the last time you felt you acted immature?
Acted mature or
immature?
Immature. I don't remember, though.
Ooh.
I don't think I have acted maturely.
Oh, wow.
In recent times.
Well, I acted immaturely yesterday morning.
We said, like, we live in a society, right? Like, you know, humans are social animals. So
yeah,
we are living
no,
in a society.
I don't know about that, but sure, okay.
Yeah. So we live in a society, like, in a society, we can find different cultures.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, for us, like, being students, we find, you know, students from different countries. And what does it mean? Like, different cultures. So here, what are you supposed to do when you're living in a place where there are people from different countries and different cultures? Like, you're supposed to adjust in between them,
yes.
right?
Yes.
So, like, you have to support the differences. You have to understand the differences.
Mm-hmm.
You're not. He's not coming from the same culture that you're coming from.
Mm. Yeah.
So what are you supposed to do over here? Like, for example, in your culture,
mm-hmm.
there might be a thing that's, you know, like, that might be offending for people. And the opposite guy, it might be really good in their culture.
Yeah, like in the Middle Eastern culture,
mm-hmm.
when someone, especially someone respectable, enters a room, we stand up for them, right?
Yeah.
We do it everywhere. In Arab culture, in Persian culture,
yeah.
in even the subcontinent,
mm-hmm.
you stand up for someone who's
yeah.
respectable and enters the room. But in African culture, certain African cultures, they find that offensive. They find it as a sign of hostility,
uh-huh.
right?
Yeah.
And I understand that. It's very important, I feel, to keep an open mind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the 21st century. It's year 2021. And
yeah.
it's the age of exposure and firsthand access to different ways of thought and worldviews. But for us, as students of the Islamic Seminary,
yeah.
I think we sort of need to look beyond just cultures. All right, bro, I'm going to cut you off right there for a sec. We're going to go for a short break and be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us again on today's episode of Youth Station. So talking about maturity, what do?
We need to respect the differences. Like we and all the listeners who are listening to us, we're living in a world where the people from different places, and we go across different places. You know, you come from a different culture and you really don't understand what the opposite person, what he's going through or what culture he's coming from. So many a times it happened with me, you know, if I joke around with my friends, you know, I have got like German friends, American friends. If I joke around with them, the one guy might not take it seriously. The other guy might get offended.
Offended, exactly.
So here, what we need to do is we need to understand that it's normal. That, you know, there are differences between people.
Obviously.
So, like, we need to act accordingly.
And more important than that, I think as Muslims, we need to look beyond those cultures in the sense of what Islam says.
True.
You know? And see what our common ground, find a common ground, and our common ground should always be Islam.
Yeah.
You think standing up for someone who's just entered is offensive. My culture says it's cool. Let's see what Islam says. That should be our criterion. That should be like, we should always refer ourselves to Islam because...
That's a basic point of Islam.
Yeah.
It has come to remove the differences between people. Like, you know, black, white, brown, anything.
Exactly. And it's meant to bring solidarity and unity
among
the people. So in Islam, there's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam that says, if your father or your teacher enters the room, stand up for them, stand up for them, even if you're a king. All right?
Yeah, your teacher is your teacher.
Yeah. And I think that the best way for us to find that maturity in different contexts and situations and environment, regardless of our background or cultural worldview, is to see what Islam teaches us to do. If you're socially awkward, you don't know how to act in a social environment, Islam tells you just stay quiet unless you're spoken to. If you don't know to stand up or say remain seated, see what Islam tells you. If you don't know to eat with your hand or eat with your fork, what does the culture like?
Right over there. I want to stop.
We're almost
there.
Out of time.
You know, some people eat like with the hand, and some people eat with
spoons. In some cultures, it's absolutely offensive.
Exactly.
The Western culture. Eat with your hands. What are you, a beast?
So, you know, some people might get offended, like, you know, when they see someone. It might be at least awkward for them when they see people, you know, eating with the hands. It's really quite normal in their culture.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, even if you eat with spoons in their culture.
Like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, what's wrong with you? So over here, the basic thing is we need to get open-minded.
Yes.
And we need to respect the
differences. The norms of the society. Because that, again, is a teaching of Islam.
True.
Amir al-Mu'mineen sent Malik al-Ashtar as a governor of Egypt, and he told him, respect the norms of their people. To a point where it does not oppose Islam. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I hope you guys could benefit from our today's discussion. And when it comes to maturity, and when in doubt, basically refer yourself to the ahadith and teaching of the Ahlul Bayt and the Holy Quran. They're our best guide and best criteria. Until next time, and another greeting, I leave you all in the care and protection of the Almighty.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator. My Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver. My defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance. Aware when I need you, the light when I see. Strength in my weakness, and my love is strong. Because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker.
the limelight.
Many of these deaths were preventable, said one Brazilian senator, adding, I am personally convinced that Bolsonaro is responsible for escalating the slaughter. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Kenny Stancil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Draft Report Accuses Bolsonaro of Crimes Against Humanity for COVID-19 Recklessness. Stay tuned for more. A Brazilian congressional probe of President Jair Bolsonaro's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic attributes more than 300,000 deaths, half of the nation's coronavirus death toll, to the far-right leader's policies. And although its initial recommendation to charge him with mass homicide and genocide has been jettisoned, the draft report still accuses him of crimes against humanity. The 1,000-plus-page document, the product of a six-month investigation led by a special COVID-19 Senate committee, asserts that Bolsonaro intentionally let the coronavirus rip through the country and kill hundreds of thousands in a failed bid to achieve herd immunity and revive Latin America's largest economy, the New York Times reported recently. According to the New York Times, the panel initially recommended in the report that Mr. Bolsonaro be charged with mass homicide and genocide against indigenous groups in the Amazon, where the virus decimated populations for months after hospitals there ran out of oxygen. But less than a day after the Times and several Brazilian news outlets reported on those plans, several senators said that the accusations had gone too far. Recently, on the eve of the scheduled release of the report, the committee removed the recommended charges of homicide and genocide. Renan Calheiros, the centrist Brazilian senator who was the lead author of the report, said, Nevertheless, the draft report accuses Brazil's far-right leader of a total of 11 crimes, including crimes against humanity, incitement to crime, and charlatanism for his obstinate promotion of ineffective remedies such as anti-malarial drug hydroxychloroquine, The Guardian reported, adding, but perhaps the most serious allegation is that Bolsonaro's shunning of offers from vaccine manufacturers during the first year of Brazil's epidemic amounted to murder. From the report, in spite of all vaccines that were on offer, the federal government opted not to buy them, a decision that went against all the scientific studies which demonstrated their safety and effectiveness and against the advice of all of the epidemiologists who declared on a daily basis that only vaccines would save lives. The decision not to acquire vaccines between the months of July 2020 and at least January 2021, which lacked any technical or scientific basis and flew in the face of recommendations from international health authorities, ended up claiming the lives of thousands of Brazilians who would undoubtedly have made use of such vaccines. In addition to shunning vaccines and promoting false solutions, Bolsonaro, who has downplayed the seriousness of the virus since the outbreak began, dismissing it as little flu, also rejected basic public health precautions and instead discouraged mask wearing and encouraged large gatherings. amid mounting anger from citizens over Bolsonaro's reckless disregard for the severity of the pandemic, the Senate panel held more than 50 hearings and often led the nightly news broadcast, The Times noted. They became must-see television in Brazil, featuring testimony about bribery schemes and disinformation operations. The committee is not scheduled to vote on the draft until next week, which means that it could still be revised by senators. Of the 11 members on the panel, 7 are opponents of Bolsonaro, who entered office in 2019. However, even if the commission greenlights the report, experts say that it is unlikely it would lead to criminal charges. That's because Brazil's lower chamber in Congress, which must approve the report, is dominated by right-wing supporters of the president, while the country's attorney general, a Bolsonaro appointee and ally, would be responsible for prosecuting him. Still, the draft text paints a devastating portrait of the neglect, incompetence, and anti-scientific denialism many believe has defined the Bolsonaro administration's response to a public health emergency that has killed more than 600,000 Brazilians, The Guardian noted. Brazil's COVID-19 death toll is second only to the United States, where nearly 720,000 have died from the disease, according to the latest figures from the World Health Organization. Journalist Carl Gibson argued that if the damning allegations against Bolsonaro are true, then the same can be said about former U.S. President Donald Trump, whose administration pursued the same herd immunity approach to COVID-19. The Guardian reported that many experts believe the congressional inquiry has done severe and lasting political damage to the standing of a politician who plans to seek re-election next year, but whose ratings have plunged to record lows. Calheiros, one of the longest-serving lawmakers in the 81-member Senate, told The Times that many of these deaths were preventable. "I am personally convinced that he is responsible for escalating the slaughter." The Times explained the next steps. Mr. Calheiros said that if the Attorney General did not pursue charges against the President, the Senate committee would seek other potential legal avenues, including in Brazil's Supreme Court and the International Criminal Court in The Hague. If Mr. Bolsonaro is formally charged, he will be suspended from office for 180 days while the Supreme Court decides the case, said Irapua Santa, a law professor at Rio de Janeiro State University. If convicted, he would be blocked from presidency for 8 years and likely face years in prison. If Bolsonaro does manage to run for another term, polls indicate that he would lose the October 2022 race to former Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, a popular leftist who improved the living standards of the country's working class when he led the country from 2003 to 2010.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. all produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
When Muslims walk together, January 9th, 2015. I deem it necessary to thank the government, people and different tribes of Iraq who made sacrifices, rendered services, and showed greatness of character in this very important test. Arba'een of Karbala was an astonishing event. The enemies of Islam and Ahlul Bayt vainly thought that they had blocked the path of Muslims. Notice what a great movement was launched when even bodies stay together. It has such a reflection. If we stay together, if Islamic governments and Muslim nations, whether Shia or Sunni, or different denominations of Shia and Sunni, are honest with one another, if they are not suspicious of one another, if they do not insult and have malevolent intentions against one another, notice what will happen in the world and what great dignity will be brought about for Islam. Unity, unity.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Muslims should know their real enemies. January 9th, 2015. This is the responsibility of everyone. Today, all Muslims throughout the world should think about the Islamic Ummah and the Islamic unity. If we think of the Islamic Ummah, the interest of our countries will be safeguarded as well. The interest of the enemy lies in separating us from one another. His interest lies in attacking one country and raising an army with the help of another country. His interest lies in this. We should not allow him to do this. Who is the enemy? The enemy is American capitalism and global arrogance, which is headed today by America and the Zionists. The Zionist government in occupied Palestine is part of the dangerous group and the deadly cancer which the Zionists have created in the world. We should stand up against them. We should refer to Islam and Quranic text in order to stand up against them.
You've done for Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A Yemeni human rights group called the Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has released a report on casualties caused by 6 years of Saudi-led war on Yemen. The report says more than 44,000 civilians have been killed or injured since 2015 when Riyadh launched an aggression against Sana'a. Thousands of women and children are among the victims, according to the report.
We released a report on the casualties of the Yemen war during the past 2,400 days of the conflict. 44,221 civilians were killed or injured, targeted by airstrikes and cluster bombs. More than 4,000 children and 2,800 women are among the victims who lost their lives.
Also, hundreds have been left with permanent disabilities. The report says thousands of civilian facilities were also targeted by the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes. Hospitals, schools, and power stations were bombed across Yemen, affecting lives of millions of Yemenis in a country already hit hard by poverty.
The Saudi-led coalition has deliberately targeted civilian facilities to kill civilians. It did not differentiate between civilian and military targets. The coalition has violated international laws that ban military attacks on civilian facilities.
However, infrastructure are not the only civilian targets hit by Saudi and coalition warplanes. According to the report, more than 500,000 homes have been destroyed during the war. As a result, millions of Yemenis have been displaced across the country.
The ongoing Saudi war and the blockade imposed on Yemen is killing more Yemenis as it has deprived millions of civilians, including children, of their basic needs such as food and medicine. However, the international community remains silent regardless of the situation in Yemen, which the United Nations describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Human rights organizations warn that the long-term Israeli blockade has led to deterioration of water crisis in Gaza, making the enclave's water undrinkable. The organizations also said the crisis has led to poisoning of the residents of the besieged enclave. The situation was exacerbated by an acute electricity crisis that hampered the operation of water wells and sewage treatment plants, leading about 80% of Gaza's untreated sewage to be discharged into the sea, while 20% seeps into underground water.
We suffer from shortage of water. Sometimes we are without water for weeks. Meanwhile, the available water is very salty, polluted, and unfit for daily uses, especially in the refugee camps. Palestinians here are forced to buy mineral water for drinking, but only a few of them can afford having it.
Israel's attacks on Gaza last May have doubled the crisis as the attacks pounded the enclave's already crumbling infrastructure. This presents a serious threat to the Gaza population's health, where recent data indicates that about a quarter of the diseases spread in Gaza are caused by water pollution, and a great number of deaths of young children and infants are linked to intestinal diseases related to polluted water.
Many children and elderly people are suffering from serious diseases due to the polluted water. Most of the families here go to hospitals on a weekly basis as they have kidney problems. We call on the International Human Rights Organization to support us.
The human rights groups also warn that the water crisis will lead to a catastrophe for the health system in the Gaza Strip and called on the international community to pressurize Israel in order to guarantee Gazans' right to water security.
لدينا محطات.
There are three centers for treating water in Gaza which need fuel. We can provide only 35% of the required amount of drinking water. The residents of Gaza cannot drink the water. Our underground water is also polluted and unfit for drinking, and most of the time we are forced to buy water.
Israel has deprived Palestinians of benefiting from the natural resources of water, which has led to a serious water security crisis in the Gaza Strip. The shortage of water is threatening the lives of 2 million Palestinians and has doubled the burden on the health system in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Recent developments in Afghanistan have marginalized attention to coronavirus crisis in the country. In the meantime, officials and doctors at Kabul's Afghan Japan COVID-19 hospital say new money has been paid to the hospital, pushing it further towards a closure.
We have many problems as the cold season is approaching. We expect another wave of the virus in coming weeks. We ask our ex-donors to pay the salaries of the employees. We can't run the hospitals on our own. If their assistance is not resumed, the only COVID-19 hospital of Afghanistan will close.
Patients getting treatment in the hospital complain about insufficient medical supplies and care, urging the international bodies to save the hospital from closing and so the lives of Afghans.
My father has contracted the coronavirus. We are here for weeks. Everything seemed okay, but today we see that the hospital suffers from lack of oxygen and medicines. Meanwhile, the doctors have not been paid for months.
This comes as the U.S. insists on freezing nearly $9.5 billion in assets belonging to the Afghan Central Bank and stopped shipment of cash to the nation. The U.S. says the assets will not be available to the Taliban, which remains on the Treasury Department's sanctions designation list. In addition to many humanitarian crises, the halt in global aid and the freezing of Afghanistan's assets have led to closure of most COVID-19 hospitals in the country. This comes amid warnings that Afghanistan could face COVID-19 outbreaks in the coming year. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Protecting press freedom. Supporters of the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange marching all the way to the British Royal Courts of Justice today ahead of an upcoming extradition hearing. The starting point, the BBC headquarters.
One of the main issues that we have with Assange is that his extradition, the case which is being heard next week, the whole basis of the case, the facts about the case, most of this never gets anywhere near the British media.
The U.S. government is attempting to extradite Assange under an old treaty with the U.K. for publishing damning documents of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and human rights violations elsewhere.